Grant, Heavenly Father, that thy Son, who did say that our hearts were hard, may soften our hearts for Jesus' sake. Amen. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 36. 1 Corinthians 7:36. But if any man think that he behave himself uncomely towards his virgin, if she pass the flower of her age and needs so require, let him do what he will, he sinneth not. Let them marry. We're not sure why Paul wrote these verses, but he had some good reason. Likely reason is that the people in Corinth had wrong views on marriage and were stopping their daughters marrying. It is also quite possible the girls themselves were refusing to marry, or that the man who they were going to marry was refusing to marry on the grounds that it was something that defiled them. Or it may just be that Paul, who had a wonderful mind, was covering every eventuality. He's been talking all the way through about marriage and singleness, and now he goes on to this question of people who are going to get married and are putting it off. Now, the way he does so makes most young people and older people today just turn off. And the reason is that he's talking to the girl's father. Now, that's a very strange way for us, because the girl decides for herself today, even though she may go through the motions. But I have noticed increasingly that young people don't even ask the father's permission when they wish to marry her daughter. The whole thing has changed enormously. But in those days, this man, her father, had complete power to say yes or no to the marriage. Now, whose father is it? Well, we think it's the girl's father. But some people think, at least modern writers write on this verse, as if it was the man she's going to marry. Well, I don't think it could be the man she's going to marry that Paul is talking to, because if you look in verse 38, which is still on the same subject, he that giveth her in marriage doeth well, but he that giveth her not in marriage doeth better. Well, it gives in marriage. The word only means give in marriage. It doesn't mean get married to. And so it is pretty clear that the person who had power over the girl's marriage is the one being spoken to. Now, there's something here that needs a good look at. And that is, he speaks of any man in an indefinite fashion. Is he meaning there is some particular man in Corinth doing this? Or does he mean any Christian man throughout? Well, it needs thinking about very carefully. You know, when my wife and I got engaged, we had to ask the permission of the head of the mission back in England. And we had to send a letter and wait for the reply. And the mission ruling was that nobody was allowed to marry after they're engaged for 2 years. And he had full power to say no for 2 years. In the early missionaries who went out, many of them sent missionaries home if they got engaged, refused to have them on the field any longer. And there are plenty of examples I could give you in Morocco, all over the place, in very many of missionary girls who wanted to marry some man and then both felt they were called to different areas and never got married. This is a real problem which comes up, and keeping an engagement which needs thinking about very, very well indeed. It may seem very old-fashioned in England today, but I can assure you that there have come up amongst us people from Islam and people from Hinduism to whom this is very real, and to whom you will have to talk, and who are fitting into the Christian church in England. Therefore, this has now become a problem in this country, and a real one, as to who has permission and what they do about it for a girl to get married. Now, the first point I make out of this is this. What a difference Christ makes. What an utter revolution in a life. Look, if Christ hasn't remade you from the sole of your feet, through your thinking, through your whole body, through your eyes and mouth and ears and nose and everything, then you're not a Christian. You may come to us week by week, but you're not born again unless that has actually happened to you. Christ said ye must be born again. Nicodemus said, how can a man be born again? The answer is of the Spirit. You must be born of the Spirit, a new person with a new heart and a new set of values and a new set of wishes, so that the old wishes have gone. And what has replaced them is a burning desire for Jesus. Now, unless that has come into your life, I deny here and now that you are a Christian. I cannot help it. I want to put it to you as strongly as I can. You've either done that or you're not Christ's. You can't sound half Christ's. Now, look at the difference it makes. I want to just show you what heathen people think about this. The father thinks of his own honour. That's what heathens do. That's why honour killings go on amongst us. Because the great point is the father's honour. Not what the girl needs. Not what she has. It's what he has that comes first. Now, I want to take you a story, a true one, which is told by a girl called Nadia, I think, from her, about her father, who was a tram conductor in Beirut, who dressed in khaki and was a very important figure in a minor way to her. She was terrified of him. And her mother carried on a relationship with another man, like many Muslim women do, and used to catch the tram and go over, taking the girl with her to catch a bus, making sure it wasn't her husband's always. And gradually the news got back to her father. And he came home furious and confronted his daughter and tried to get the truth out of her. And this is what she wrote: the blows fell on my face and head. I tried to think clearly as the words of the Lord of the tram car thundered and drowned out the nervous voice of my mother, afraid I might reveal all. The blows continued, the voice cutting through me like a knife. My mother cried out, are you mad, Ibrahim? Leave the girl alone. Leave the girl alone. Now that's how Islamic people think about this. He paid no attention to her, but continued to shower me with blows, his voice lashing out at me. And so the account goes on. What Ibrahim was angry about was his honour before the other cab drivers and before the other tram drivers and conductors in Beirut. And that was everything to him. Not his girl's needs or wishes or his wife's or anything else. Well, now that's part of Arab life, but it goes further than that. You take this account by an Algerian lady novelist who says that she saw this incident. A poor girl from the mountains. At marriage, her husband denounced her. In fact, quite wrongfully, she said. Her in-laws were furious and disowned her. They put her on a donkey facing the tail with her head shaved and her arms tied. And they took her back to her family. Her elder brother stabbed her to death because she had dishonored the family. Now, you can see what those men felt and thought before they became Christians. Now, if they changed, there is nothing you couldn't change if you had a mind to. If you wanted to. And the reason you're not changed is because you don't want to change. It's your own fault entirely. There's nothing from Christ. All from you is the blockage. If you wish, you could change as much as you wish. You could change to be the greatest saint on earth if you so desired. But the lack is the desire. That's where it's wrong. It's inside yourself. The fault here, Brutus said, Shakespeare's not in our stars, but in ourselves. Now that's what this is getting at. These men had changed in Corinth and continually were thinking about what the daughter needed and not what they needed. Not their own honour. Now, what then was this that we've got in front of us? Well, the man had come and listened to Paul. And as Paul preached, the man realized that he was a sinner. He repented of his sin totally, without reservation. I have no doubt that, like Paul says, the Galatians would have torn out their eyes and given them to him when he preached to them. The Colossians felt the same. They'd have given him anything they had because they were given the chance of a breakout from this terrible prison of self, this awful slavery of sin, this wicked city, this awful life they were living, and a totally new life. Have you entered new life? Is life totally new for you, or is that old hat and something forgotten, and life is a dreary drudge of keeping up with something or other that's in your life? I wonder. That's what had happened to this man, and it's old things had passed away. Behold, all things became new. Well, now, you might think that the result of that would be that everybody would say, what a fine fellow he is. Immediately, his neighbors turned against him. His family said, you've betrayed the gods. The whole neighborhood rose up against him. The man was a marked man. His honor had gone. You know what Wesley said? Said, when I come into a town, it's all, yes, Mr. Wesley, yes, sir, no, sir. But when I start to preach the gospel, then the mud and stones start to fly. And it's so with your neighbours, isn't it? If you were to preach to them, do you know, I read the personal account of a Lutheran bishop who had worked among the tribes up above Peshawar, the tribes on the borders of Afghanistan. They're a rough, hard lot. Oh, they were hard. Hard beyond all description. Well now, he said, with tears in his eyes, they killed my son because I preached Christ to them, and if I'd really been faithful, they would have killed me. And he said, I feel guilty to be alive for having not spoken out better for the Lord. Have you never had that feeling? Have you never ever felt, have I even begun to be a Christian? Have I ever got anywhere in it? Well, you see, these men had. They'd made a great stride forward, an enormous one. And just because once in the past you made such a stride doesn't mean you're making it now. But you should be striding in seven-league boots towards heaven, changing every day out of recognition into something holy and just and true, and tell people see your face like they saw the face of an angel in those early Christians. Now, the next thing I want to take from these verses is this. If God brings Christ to the front of his heart, what has changed is the man's view of God, and so his religion becomes the religion of God. What a transformation has come into his life. You see, it's like this. If you become a Muslim, you will say prayers at the set times 5 times a day. You will, when Ramadan begins, stop eating until the end of the month. If you're pregnant, if you're sick, if you're taking medicines, if you're working on a building site in the midst of the Sahara heat, the boss may lie on a bed upstairs and gasp, but you, I've seen them, working in the dust all day. You'll go on working up and down the ladders, carrying the bricks and bringing down the hobs empty, and then taking up the pails of water and all the rest, right through the heat of the day. Even though it's Ramadan, nobody is exempt. The children don't get to school, and when they do, they fall asleep at their desks, because the only eating is done at night. The whole country falls a month behind the West, each time, because everything stops and everything has to be caught up again at the end. Murders go up, road accidents go up. Now that is how religion works. But it worked just the opposite for these men here. That what had been right before is not necessarily right now. In Christianity, it's what we read in the lesson. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In Ramadan, the Muslim is made for Ramadan, not Ramadan for the Muslim. And he has to jolly well do it. He has to go on and on doing it. But in Christianity, what's right today may be wrong another day, and what's wrong another day may be right another day. So Paul isn't changing his voice here when he says, if need so require. What he's saying is this: if the girl needs to marry, and I suppose he means if the young man she's marrying needs to marry too, then let her marry. Let her do what let him do what he will. He isn't sinning. He says it's not a sin to let her marry. Let the pair of them marry now. Now, if the father then sees that his daughter has a need to marry, he should let her marry. He may not altogether like the young man. He may not altogether think he's perfect and all the rest. But let them. And now, some people think that Paul here is teaching something quite different. He's teaching spiritual marriage. And there was an idea, and there is a reviving idea today, that a man and a woman, as Christians, can enter a spiritual marriage, a sort of platonic one. Well, such a dangerous and foolish idea would never be put forward by the Apostle Paul. It would be bound to end in a tragedy. So, I'm sure he's not teaching that. But what he's teaching is, everything goes on the need. The religion fits the need. That's why Christ is so angry with those Pharisees we read about today. Because the need of the man was healing. The day was the Sabbath when they didn't allow any work. And he rode the need over the day. And that was very important. It was quite correct. God hadn't forbidden it. It was their foolish way of having this oral law that did it. Now, Paul always speaks of in the present distress, and he doesn't say that it's best to marry here. He says let them marry. Now then he he goes on with it. He says the same thing as he says in chapter 7 verse 9, if you look at it. But if they cannot contain, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn. But there's a third point arises here. Paul's first choice is that the girl is not given in marriage. Nevertheless, he that standeth fast in his heart, having no necessity, but hath power over his own will, and hath so decreed in his heart that he will keep his virgin, doeth well. Now, when he says steadfast, we've got to make a difference. Certain people, from their birth, are blessed with very strong wills. And those wills can become a simple curse to other people. You know what the Muslims say? If two men dwell in a house for 1 year, or two people, they say, one of them is patient. And we don't want to be so stubborn that it exercises the other person's patience to the absolute limit day by day. There are people who confuse that with being strong. That isn't being strong. It's only the strength of a donkey. I have seen a donkey so stupid that when it was offered the shade, it just stood under the burning African sun for hours and hours on end. Well, that may be stubborn, and it may decide to stand in the sun, but it's a silly thing to do. All the more pliable animals, like dogs and sheep and that, got into the shade and stayed there, and so did the humans. but not the donkey. Now, that's not what we're after here. He's not saying steadfastness in the idea of pig-headedness and refusal to listen to reason and stubbornness. But what he says is steadfast in his heart. And that means a good conscience. Having no necessity. That means having power over his own will. It means that there's no necessity. Well, now what is a necessity and why does he put it in? Because partly slaves were listening to him and they had no power at all in this matter. But partly because some of these people who are talking to had entered into a marriage agreement. Now that's a necessity, says Paul. If you've entered into an agreement that you will marry the girl, well, you're under a necessity. But if there's no such agreement, you're not under necessity. If it's just a friendship or just an understood thing between you, you're not under the same necessity. Now, what the Christian has to decide in many cases is where does necessity truly start? You see, Bishop Ryle was not responsible for the fact that his father was a banker and went broke. But he took all his father's debts on himself personally and repaid every one. He repaid the lot. He worked for years and years simply to repay his father's debts. And you will find other people have done the same. A necessity is a thing which you have to decide where it starts and where it's going to end. And we have to do it before the Lord. Now, there's also, we need to face the fact that he is not releasing people from marriage in order to live together. Sadly, that is growing in the churches, an acceptance of it, so that there are people teaching in our churches, in commentaries, that it is all right to recognize in church the fact people are living together. They say at least they're being faithful to each other. If they're faithful to each other, why don't they make the vows and bind themselves to it? The fact is they're refusing to make the vows and refusing to bind themselves to it. Now, Paul is quite clear all through this chapter that marriage is forever, as long as this world lasts. It's another world, it's a different matter. But marriage never stops. There's no break in marriage. You can't just end a marriage like that. Paul is quite clear on the matter here. But he says here almost the opposite. He says, well, you can go back and you can stop the matter. You see, Christianity tempers the wind to the shorn lamb. It is not the other way round. And it's a wonderful thing. He has decreed in his heart, that's with a good conscience, that he will keep his virgin, doeth well. So that is what Paul is teaching there. And then he goes on, he's not contradicting himself, so then he that giveth her in marriage doeth well. Now doeth well is in the present tense. And Paul was a very subtle writer. And it carries the connotation, does well to a point, does well in this life, does well at this moment. It's what she badly wants, and she'll jump up and put her arms around his neck and give her a kiss if he'll say, yes, you can go ahead and get married. He does well. But he that giveth her not in marriage doeth better. And when it says giveth her not, it's the future tense, doeth better. The idea is that the better is the future of the girl, so that in the end she will do better unmarried. Now I know he's talking about the present distress, and I know there are various views on what that means, either the Nero persecution and the troubles they were in, or the troubles of any marriage anywhere in the Christian life, and you must decide that one for yourself. But he definitely prefers that they don't get married for various reasons. Look at verse 32. But I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and that ye may attend upon the Lord without distraction. That's what he's been saying. Now, then he turns to widows, and at the end, in verse 39, he says something. The idea of the Christian church in the early days was that a widow shouldn't marry. In fact, they gave what was called the couplet of chastity, which was a sort of wreath of laurel leaves, to any widow in the Christian church who didn't remarry. Whereas they regarded as sinful a second marriage and refused to allow clergy to officiate at it or even attend it. And later on, they even said that a person who got married a third time, a widow, was out of the church, she was excommunicated. So then Paul is teaching something very necessary and very wise. He says, you yourselves agree that the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband lives. She's bound by this law that she's not to remarry while he lives. That's quite clear. But if her husband be dead, she's at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. So he cuts right across the thinking of the early church, and right across the thinking of his day. And Paul was never afraid to lay in front of people a complete bar to their thinking progress and say, no further, this is the way you should go, somewhere entirely different to the way you're going. Turn round and go that way. That's what he's saying, and it's a very necessary thing, he says. But she's happier if she so abide, he says. Well, what's he teaching here? He's teaching that she's better if she doesn't remarry. Not that it's wrong to do so, she'll be happier. You see, most of the older women remarried partly because they had no means of income and partly just for companionship. And many older women have remarried, just really they need companionship. Well, Paul says, you'll enter into a whole lot more difficulties if you do. You're happier if you so abide. You see, I can think of homes at this moment where the children won't go home because the father or mother has remarried. And there are all sorts of problems of that sort. And after the husband or wife has died, it leads to many problems of remarriage. You see, she's happier so abide after my judgment. Now, he is not saying, I'm giving you my personal opinion. What he's saying is, I am an apostle. I am faithful, God counted me faithful, and I am telling you faithfully what the Holy Spirit is saying about this. But I'm not giving a command of Christ. It's my judgment, not what Christ said. You remember we said that Christ did not lay down a rule book. Many contingencies were not covered, and the apostles were sent to lead us into all truth, so that the Bible leads us into all contingencies being covered. And even then we have to use these principles to meet our own contingencies. I think also that I have the Spirit of God. He's not saying he thinks as a matter of doubt, but that speaking as a Greek would, a gentleman, you don't put it that I know, but I think that I have. In other words, I have the Spirit of God. Well now, that's what God has shown us in this chapter. Amen.